Get your daily market recap on the latest stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It offers flexible spending capacity that adapts to your business. You can also earn up to $395 in annual statement credits on eligible purchases at select business merchants. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene, along with Jonathan Farrell and Lisa Abramowitz. Daily, we bring you insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg Terminal. I'm going to talk about the long term, and I can do that with Joyce Chang, chair of global research at JP Morgan, who I really don't like because she put out a 7-page special with a giant Phil Schlegel, Mike Feroli helping out, Jan Loys and the rest of JP Morgan on the fiscal state of the country. Joyce, I've got to read every word of this report, and it's a path out to 2052. Nobody's talking about this except you. How ugly is it for the nation in our fiscal policy out 30 years?
Hey, it's looking pretty ugly, Tom. I mean, we're looking at debt levels that are going to a record level. We're close to 100%, going to 170%, 188%. And if you take a look at our view that 10-year treasury yields are at 5.5% by the end of the decade, you're well north of 200% of GDP on the debt level. And this is going to raise real questions about fiscal sustainability and the debt trajectory if we see interest rates continue to rise. Because the CEO on a 10-year view is using only 3.8% for their treasury yields. You know, Tom, we've got 3.35% by the end of the year.
You know, you've got a great set on this call. The only one that looks tanned and rested, by the way, is Feroli. And we know, you know, he's leading a cushy life. Let's start with the tanned and rested Feroli. Do we have the productivity and spirit of this economy, the little growth rate of Joe Stiglitz, to grow ourselves out of this conundrum?
Well, you've got to look at productivity for the first half of the year, and it was, as Mike says, atrocious, nearly 7% decline. And we're looking at pretty poor productivity ahead. So you take any metric, you know, Larry Summers, Jason Furman, and you look 10 years out, and on our view, you're at something that looks really unsustainable. And I think this is a conversation that's going to start right now, because the real conversation is still on where are we at in the cycle and what kind of landing is it? Is it a hard landing or a soft landing? Yes, we're avoiding an imminent recession, but we've got to look at what potential growth is going forward, and we have it at only 1.5% going forward.
All right, Joyce, that's exactly where I wanted to go. If we could put this moment into the trajectory of 30 years, what would it look like? Would it be a pivot point to add more debt ahead of the tsunami, or would it be a pivot point to some sort of higher inflationary regime because of the geopolitical backdrop and the reshoring that you're seeing by a lot of companies?
Well, look, there's the reshoring, the deglobalization, but there's also just poor demographics that we're talking about here. And that's kind of a trend that we're seeing, look, in Europe and China as well. But it's taking potential growth down. And we put that along with, you know, what we see as labor productivity, which is too optimistic in the congressional budget, you know, line. And that really is a key reason why we think the potential growth, the productivity is going to be lower going forward. You know, on top of that, we do see rising treasury yields that are on the horizon. So you take a look at just where we are with the primary deficit, and you're going up to levels that really do point to debt sustainability when we look at the debt service.
And this is
and you take a look at this, and it's going to just, you know, really with the healthcare spending, that's going to go up because of the demographics.
And this is one reason why a lot of people have the confidence to go into longer term treasuries, because they say there is no way that this nation, given all the debt, can allow yields to climb for a persistent level because of that debt sustainability. Before getting into the theory of that, I want to go to the moment that we're in, because we're getting a lot of gloom out of Wall Street. A lot of the analytic notes are basically saying people are way too optimistic. The rally doesn't really count. It's a bear market rally. And then you can see it continue to bleed up, the rally gaining steam. What makes for this huge divergence between the tone among the top Wall Street analysts and the tone among traders in the trenches?
Well, look, we've seen bear market rallies like in March, and then the market sold off again. And that's the question, where are we right now? Look, it's just clear that the Fed has a lot more work to do. And I think we're all looking at what's going to come out on Wednesday with the CPI number. Now, Feroli has the forecast at 8.7%. I mean, that's still going to keep the Fed on high alert. And we have 75 basis points in our forecast for what the Fed has to do, and still 25 basis points in November, December. But a terminal rate, which we were talking, you know, 3.25%. Now we think could go up to 3.75% before we really see inflation concerns come down. Now, it's not the cyclical inflation. It's the structural inflation. So it's the wage growth, but also rent inflation, which we have sort of north of 7%. Wage growth is still north of 5%. So that's what we're focused on, you know, in the coming days. A soft landing, I think, is going to be difficult. This immaculate disinflation scenario, I think it's going to be very difficult to see that play out.
Well, and obviously we'll be watching the inflation data on Wednesday, but we'll be viewing it through the lens of the jobs report we got on Friday, which showed an incredibly strong labor market still and escalating wage pressures in the economy. Yet that strong jobs report runs in contrast to some softer data we have seen in other parts. And I'm just wondering if you can glean a consistent message from the economic data we are seeing now.
Look, we have come into this, you know, this part of the cycle with excess savings, and that's actually been a real cushion across developed markets and also in emerging markets. But that excess savings is being, you know, going to weigh down. So on the third quarter of the year, we have just, you know, 1% growth for the U.S. That's what we're looking at. But you've had very strong wage growth, you know, the labor market being very strong, also, you know, consumers holding in because of this excess you know, savings that they come into the cycle with, but you're going to work through some of that by the end of the year. So I think we also have to look at what's happening outside of the United States. I mean, we've got Europe numbers sliding. China sort of has disappointed on the stimulus. And on top of that, remember that these moves in the month of August are on very, very poor liquidity. I mean, we're heading into some of the worst liquidity months where liquidity is really amplified positively and negatively. So we're at a point in the cycle right now where there's a relief of no imminent recession, but I just think that the liquidity also amplifies these moves. We could see a very choppy market ahead.
Well, Joyce, you mentioned China, and obviously we consider it from an economic standpoint, but there's geopolitical risks to consider as well as we see continued drills happening in and around Taiwan. How do you view just the tension between the U.S. and China, potential decoupling further of the world's two largest economies, and what that ultimately is going to mean for the trajectory of the global economy moving forward?
Look, when we think about decoupling, we have to think about what's desirable and undesirable. And you really have to separate the global manufacturing hub from some of these issues, which are much more about national security and critical infrastructure. But that's pretty tricky. And that's what U.S. Taiwan is showing us when we look at just the concerns about the supply chain, because you have so much of the supply chain really that does move through the Taiwan Straits. And when we look at this and revisit what the precedents are, 1995, 96, when you had these kinds of tensions, you had a financial market sell-off, but not that much impact to the real economy. Now the economies are much more integrated between Taiwan's dependency on Hong Kong and China trade, and also the global supply chain. So I think that this is a tricky moment. I'm not so sure you're going to see these military exercises come to a halt as quickly as people are, you know, hoping will occur.
Joyce, I want to go back to your wonderful fiscal essay. Folks, you can get that from J.P. Morgan. It's just a really tour de force with Phil Schlegel of CBO. Joyce, a simple question for our listeners on radio, our viewers on TV. Is the United States becoming like France?
Look, what we're doing is really going to affect future generations if there isn't some attention that's paid to the fiscal and the debt trajectory. I mean, we're looking at debt servicing costs that are going to double here and, you know, record levels of debt that we've never seen before. So simply, the fiscal outlook is unsustainable. So you could compare it to France, you could compare it to Japan on the debt ratios, but I think that it is really a moment where you have to look at what needs to be done, particularly if we see Treasury yields continue to rise, because all of this looked very benign when we were at zero Treasury yields. But you really can see how this actually can change by the course of a decade. We're not talking 50 years.
Joyce Chang, thank you so much. A tour de force with J.P. Morgan, as always.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
A good time to segue over to Peter Scheer. He's head of macro strategy at Academy Securities. Academy is in Annapolis and, of course, is a Wall Street shop with a huge military bent. Peter, I would be remiss if I didn't speak to you of your board's esteemed public service and their thoughts on what we're seeing on the Pacific Rim and Taiwan. Has that affected your call across the broad market?
Yeah, it's something we're very focused on. We have 17 retired generals and admirals who serve as our geopolitical intelligence group, and about 50% of the company are veterans. So first, it's very near and dear to our hearts, but I think we are looking at the escalation of what China is doing. And it doesn't necessarily turn into something military, but it plays on this theme that we've been seeing China separate from the rest of the world, become much more inward looking. And China is going to continue to develop relationships with autocratic nations at the expense of dealing with the West.
Peter, how much do you buy into this rally that we've seen, the 13% gain in the S&P since that mid-June low? How much do you view this as wishful thinking at a time of so much geopolitical and inflationary uncertainty?
I would say I think it's very wishful thinking. Having said that, with VIX down at 22, I like the idea of just buying calls and puts coming into the end of the summer. There is so little liquidity. Either side could get traction. It feels right now, again, the bulls are getting traction, especially after we, you know, survived Friday. But to me, the inventory overhang, that remains a big concern. And I'm just a little bit suspicious about how good the job data was on Friday.
Suspicious in that it's not going to turn out to be that strong once we get the revisions, Peter?
Yeah, there's already right now over the last 4 months, you've had this big disconnect between the establishment survey, which is the headline number, and then the household survey, which goes into the unemployment rate. There are about 1.8 million jobs different over the last 4 months, which is a pretty big thing. So if the household started to confirm what we're seeing in the establishment, that would mean that the unemployment rate is probably much, much lower, which puts pressure on the Fed, or we're going to get some revisions. And I suspect it's going to be more revisions to the establishment, and it'll pull us a little bit more in line with other anecdotal evidence on jobs.
Does that mean you're more in line with the Fed pivot narrative?
Yes, I think the Fed is going to have to pivot. I think the Fed's already gone too far. I think you're seeing inflation roll over. I think you see supply chains fix themselves. But it's the fact that the consumer looks like they're trying to buy things on discount, that you're seeing margin pressure. I think all those are actually going to be relatively, I don't know that we get to the point of being deflationary.
Right.
But I think by the end of this year, we're not talking about inflation anymore.
Peter, it's Inside Baseball Monday. That's what you do when the Padres are swept by the Dodgers. So we're going there. Peter, I think I just heard you say you want to do a collared transaction because we may go long or we may go short. You and I remember long ago when you do like a six option trade and Peter Scheer would do an iron condor or something like that. Can you be creative in options now, or do you eat it all up in premium?
You eat some of it in premium, but again, as you mentioned, VIX is all the way back to 22. So VIX is pretty low given the day-to-day volatility we're seeing. So I think you can trade your way out of it.
Pete, how much is a Fed pivot going to be positive for equities versus negative?
I think it's going to turn out to be more negative at first. I think the realization that the market hasn't hit is the Fed is going to be pivoting because they've pushed too far. So I'm definitely not in the soft landing camp. I think we pushed too far. I think we're seeing the consumer roll over. I think you're seeing inventories build. So when people realize that we're going to have to pivot, the first reaction, yes, maybe we rally. And I think that's the stage we've been in. But then the reality is going to hit like, whoa, we have to be very careful. What are future earnings going to look like? And it's very encouraging to see this kind of merger Monday because you're seeing companies kind of accept new valuations. But I think we're a long way from being done, especially on the high flyers where they still want to get paid X, the buyers are at Y, and we've got to sort themselves out. And I think, unfortunately, it's going to be closer to Y, the lower prices that come to fruition.
Peter Scheer, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it with Academy Securities there, particularly the update on their thoughts on what's going on in the Pacific Rim. Right now, we're going to recalibrate into the Wednesday inflation report with Dana Peterson. She's chief economist at the Conference Board, with all of the ability of the Conference Board to look at a different set of data out there. And I want to go, Dana, I know Lisa's really focused on a job full economy, but I want to go to your call for restriction by the Fed after Jackson Hole. Are we going to calibrate for September 1 after Jackson Hole? Do we just need to get to Wyoming before we can look to the Fed meeting?
Well, Wyoming certainly is beautiful, but I think that the Fed is certainly data dependent. We're going to get several more readings on inflation, another jobs report, certainly updates on GDP. And I think the Fed is going to be looking at all of these indicators to determine whether or not it needs to go another 75 basis points or 50 basis points. But I think whatever it is, the Fed is going to continue to raise interest rates to really arrest inflation.
I mean, let's do the math here. If it's 175 beat move, or it's 250 beat moves, which is a stick, I get it. But what's a so what? Whether it's one move or two moves is a precursor to restriction. Does it matter?
Well, I think, you know, just getting above 3% on the Fed funds rate, that's restriction. And, you know, we can sit around and argue about it, but I think the fact
that we don't do that on surveillance.
The fact that the Fed's been raising rates this aggressively, this quickly, you know, it certainly is going to feel restrictive. We're already seeing that show up in the GDP data.
Dana, do you buy the data that we get on Friday? We heard Peter Scheer just earlier saying that the data doesn't seem to cohere with some of the granular on the ground specific inputs. So do you think that it's going to get revised a lot lower and it's going to give a less rosy picture of the labor market?
Well, I mean, how much can you revise down? That was an astounding number. Over more than 500,000 jobs added in July. That would be a huge downward revision. And whatever the revisions are, they're probably going to be minor. What the labor market's telling us is that we still have a very strong labor market. Many people are seeing their wages rise. Many people are being hired, especially in those in-person services that struggle to find workers. It's really astounding what we're seeing. And I don't think that the numbers are lying to us.
So let's talk about what we heard from Peter Buchvar, which I thought was really fascinating, that Tom brought up, that people are over hiring and companies are scarred by what happened post-pandemic when they fired a lot of people and then had to bring on staff that just was not there. How much is that going to be a persistent theme throughout whatever happens in this next cycle?
We think that labor shortages are here to stay. A lot of it's demographic. You have more people retiring from the labor market than you do young people available to refill those jobs. We also have very strict immigration policies in the U.S. That makes it very difficult to find labor from outside of the country. And still, you have many people who are challenged with childcare issues. Many people don't want to work 2 and 3 jobs. That's why they're trying to find higher wage jobs. We think that this is just going to be an issue even beyond what we're thinking is going to be a brief recession in the U.S.
Okay, so what does that mean for how persistent upward pressure on wages is likely to be?
Well, certainly if inflation continues to be elevated and the Fed struggles to get back down to the 2% inflation target, we think that there's probably the potential for a wage price spiral. Already, if you match up the PCE deflator with the ECI, they're both moving together. And that's really a challenge that the Fed is trying to prevent from happening with its actions.
But obviously, its actions have a lagged effect. It takes a while for us to see the real impact of it, as evidenced by how strong the payrolls report was on Friday. So can the Fed act quickly enough that they are actually going to be able to lasso that and get that under control? Or are we going to be looking at a situation where this actually does end up eventually out of the Federal Reserve's hands?
Well, I think the Fed is acting as quickly as it can. I mean, other than raising rates every month, certainly at every meeting since March, they've raised interest rates, and I think the Fed's doing what it can. But as you said, monetary policy comes with a lagged effect. First, you're going to see the effects on things like mortgage rates and the housing market, and then consumer spending, and then inflation. And so it's going to take some time, but we feel that the Fed can probably do its job and get things done right in terms of bringing down inflation.
Dana, does OER, does any measurement of housing rent or ownership get in the way of their plan? I mean, can housing be such a crisis, so expensive, so persistent, that it just gets in the way of their best outcomes?
Well, surely housing is a huge driver of inflation right now for consumers in the U.S. And certainly as long as home prices, the valuations of new and existing homes continue to rise, that's going to show up in the OER and in rents with a lag, of course. And so that really does present a challenge for the Fed.
Dana, I got to leave it there. Dana Peterson, thank you so much. Greatly appreciate it with the conference board.
Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update is an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Join host Keith Lansford for this information-packed daily market recap, delivered in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcast. That's schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
It's always an important conversation with Libby Cantrell, head of public policy strategy at PIMCO. But this morning, after historic legislation, it's really critical as well. We're thrilled Libby Cantrell could join us here at our world headquarters. Libby, I want to cut to the chase. How do you put into process the legislation of thousands of pages?
Well, that's a good question. Fortunately, Washington is quite expert at doing that. Most bills tend to be hundreds, if not thousands, of pages. But I think that what what this sort of underscores how quickly this bill was able to come together to be passed by the Senate, we passed by the House later this week, and then promptly signed into law, is that many of these ideas, Tom, mm-hmm. have actually been percolating in Washington for years. Take the drug pricing right. in terms of allowing Medicare to negotiate drug prices with pharma. That is a concept that literally has been percolating since I was on the Hill back in 2003. So in some ways, many of these ideas, again, have already been
right.
in text, were able to be put into legislation immediately. The big question, of course, was just to get that fit, that unity, that unanimity right. among those 50 senators on the Democratic
the
side.
Question I asked our Jack Fitzpatrick, can the Republicans take it away if they win the House and the Senate?
Can they take it away? It will be very difficult. And I think what you've seen, even with the Trump tax cuts, is it's very difficult to take things away, to take benefits away, particularly on something like the drug pricing for mm-hmm. Medicare. That's something that polls incredibly well. More than 80% of Americans support that provision. Older people tend to vote. So particularly for that, difficult to take away. And then on the climate piece, and you know, as a reminder, $400 billion of tax incentives for production and for consumption on the sort of the clean energy tax
right.
front. All of that, pretty difficult to take away as well. And most of those right. last for 10 years.
And Lisa, I looked at the Medicare-Medicaid combination for federal budget. Thank you, Robert Jameson, for helping out of Washington. And not out of 65 and LBJ, but roughly Nixon, we've gone from 1% of GDP out really approaching 6% of GDP for those two programs.
I did not know that. That's really fascinating. And a reason why this has been such a big issue. And of course, I looked at the pharmaceutical company's shares ahead of the open, thinking that they'd be tanking because they were going to get less income from Medicare. They are not, Libby, which raises a question about what the tangible effect on investment will be from this bill. If even, you had David Sowerby on earlier decrying some of the concerns about the taxes on buybacks, share repurchases, as well as that minimum corporate tax imposed. Is there a corporate read-through that is not getting priced in, or is this not a significant a move in terms of crimping profits, as some would say?
Yeah, so Lisa, on your point about the pharma companies, they actually got a little bit of a lifeline over the weekend because one of the bigger provisions that was in the bill that would have required that pharmaceutical companies negotiate with private insurers on the pharma prices actually got stripped out of the bill because of some parliamentary mumbo jumbo, didn't qualify for the so-called reconciliation bill. So that's maybe why you're actually seeing a little bit of support in those names this morning. But overall, I don't think we should overstate the impact of this bill. I think invariably there will be winners and losers, losers like the pharmaceutical industry, because some of those provisions obviously still persisted. Technology, some of the companies that have been able to take advantage of this sort of book income corporate tax rate sort of arbitrage will also be losers. And then, big winners, obviously, renewables, which are really priced in. So I think sort of the macro impact or even the sector impact has likely been pretty much priced in here. But overall, in sort of my world, the political impact, I don't think has actually been priced in. I think this is a huge boon for Democrats who really needed it, right? The price of gas, Biden's disapproval ratings, the generic ballot, all have been major headwinds for the Democrats going into the midterms. And here they are. Here they are able to go in at sort of the 11th hour and really campaign on the fact that they can govern and that they can get a big piece of their agenda that they campaigned on in 2020 through, which was the climate piece.
So, Libby, what is the market read-through in terms of if the Democrats keep the Senate, if the Democrats don't lose as much of the House, which seems to be the feeling that's increasingly getting speculated upon?
Yeah, so I think, Lisa, the conventional wisdom that the Democrats will lose the House is probably right. If you look at history, right, since World War II, the party in power has lost an average of 25 seats in the House. So just if passes prologue, Democrats face an uphill battle. But the margins there do count. I think our view is that they could lose maybe as little, as few as 10 seats or as many as 50 seats, sort of depending on voter enthusiasm and what's actually happening in sort of October and to the buildup of November. And that margin does matter because in the long term, because that means if they lose fewer seats, then they're going to be able to more likely recapture the House in 2024. On the Senate, though, and we've been saying this for a while, it's much more of a jump ball. The Senate tends to not be as much of a national election because, of course, only a third of the Senate seats are up for reelection. Mm-hmm. Republicans have actually a more difficult map this cycle. And some of the candidates that are running on the Republican ticket in battleground states like Georgia and Pennsylvania, maybe even in Ohio, are sort of less experienced, more green, and as a result, maybe have less of a chance to win, even when the national mood is really much more supportive for Republicans. So I think bottom line here is the House is likely lost for Democrats, at least at this point, but the margin does matter. The Senate, much more of a jump ball. Lastly, in terms of the sort of the policy implications, though, as long as Republicans take back just one chamber, that means that Biden's legislative agenda for the next 2 years is likely, you know, dead or at least on ice for a bit. There's still some chance of bipartisan legislation around tech and some other areas, but probably on ice. So that really is, for the market's perspective, what people will be really focused on. But again, folks like me are focusing a little bit on the longer term and sort of the read through for 2024 in particular.
Well, Libby, you mentioned voter enthusiasm a moment ago. I'm wondering if there's a lesson to be learned from Kansas and the abortion vote there, the turnout that we saw. Is there an underestimation of the galvanizing effect that some of the social issues like abortion may actually have on voters approaching the midterm beyond just kind of the macroeconomic environment?
Yeah, again, and this is, again, another piece of good news that the Democrats have had over the last several weeks. Of course, voter turnout in Kansas much higher than expected. That ballot initiative lost by almost 20 points. Now, there are some idiosyncrasies that I think are maybe difficult to extrapolate from Kansas sort of nationally. Mm-hmm. But I think it is, I think that for Democrats, their big takeaway is that this is a galvanizing issue. Now, one important distinction, of course, is that was a particular issue that was on the ballot versus just, the midterm elections, which are more general, right, where candidates are on the ballot.
Quickly, and this is completely unfair, but it's unfair Monday here, we have this ginormous legislation. Is this the window for President Biden to say he's a one-term president?
I highly doubt he will do that. Yeah. I mean, theoretically, sure. I think he will not do that, especially before the midterms. But I think, Tom, it's a good point in that he will likely have to decide whether he really is going to run for 2024 shortly thereafter. Remember that in the debates start in June of next year. So we actually need to have a pretty good idea.
Can't we be like the British? Where the hell is Pharaoh? Get Pharaoh back.
He's not going to come back if you make that British accent again.
That Old Republic.
Lisa, come on. The British like to get it done, Sunak, Truss, and all that. And Libby's depressing me with debate. You know, the debates start in June.
Yes. Well, if 2019 were any.
How many people will be on stage? Like, I mean, who 42 knows? People?
Well, look, I think if President Biden does not win, that we are going to see a very kind of open and potentially kind of messy and raucous primary on the Democratic side, and the same thing on the Republican side.
Oh, last time wasn't raucous.
No, exactly. I think that will be the last time it was just on one
the
side,
British
right?
Do it so, come on, the British do it so
I know.
Much
well, it's
better.
Also a parliamentary system, Tom. You know that. I mean, this is different.
It's a what?
A parliamentary system.
Tom knows
system,
a lot of things.
Really?
That he likes to
protect. I did not know that. Thank you, Elizabeth Kennedy. Trump, greatly appreciate that. This is the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Thanks for listening. Join us live weekdays from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio and on Bloomberg Television each day from 6 to 9 a.m. for insight from the best in economics, finance, investment, and international relations. And subscribe to the Surveillance Podcast on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Terminal. I'm Tom Keene, and this is Bloomberg.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.